Welcome to Studio Tulsa on Health. I'm John Schumann, sitting in for Rich Fisher. As Americans continue to live longer into old age, we find ourselves dealing with frailty in new and challenging ways. One of the biggest medical problems of frail elders is falling due to many factors, among them loss of balance, declining vision, and a diminished sense of where our bodies are situated, something we call proprioception. When frail elders fall, often the result is a broken hip, which can be devastating for patients and their families alike. People with hip fractures often are never able to return to their previous level of functioning. They can lose their abilities to walk and care for themselves independently, and even though a hip fracture seems like a mere mechanical problem that can easily be remedied with current medical techniques and know-how, it often serves as a harbinger of decline and death. There are more than 250,000 hip fractures every year in the U.S. in people 65 and older, and something that may shock you is that 20% of those patients will die within a year of their injury. KERA Radio, our sister public radio station in Dallas, has put together a superb multimedia resource on the problem of hip fractures. Led by health reporter Lauren Silverman, KERA compiled 8 chapters worth of stories, including an array of text, audio, photos, video, and infographics with links to additional resources for patients and caregivers alike. I've been recommending the series as a resource to families and caregivers locally, and I was curious what went into its production. I interviewed Lauren Silverman from KERA in Dallas. Lauren Silverman, welcome to Studio Tulsa on Health.
Thank you so much.
I want to start by asking you what inspired you to do this set of stories on hip fracture.
Well, it's a good question because I actually don't have, my parents aren't quite at the age yet where they've become one of these statistics that we talk about. And really, it's something that I hear a lot about as a reporter, constantly hearing people talk about, oh, my mom fell and fractured her hip, my dad had this happen, and it just started coming up again and again and again. And my news editor had the original idea for doing some sort of project on the broken hip, really focusing in on it as this catalytic moment that changes everything for a person and for their family and for the caregivers. And so then we just started brainstorming from there.
And what is so spectacular about this series is, first of all, this the visual. So of course we're on radio here and can't do it justice, but it just looks absolutely so amazing. So if you're near a computer, I strongly encourage you to go. And of course, we'll link to this on our own website, but it's projects.kera.org/thebrokenhip. So it's beautiful and it's multimedia. So you not only have the stories, you have these wonderful photographs, you have some video, and of course you have audio, it being essentially a radio station. And how did you find these stories?
That was probably the hardest part because we really wanted to feature different families and people in different situations and look at a different issue in each story. So we actually broke it down by chapters, and there's 8 chapters, and who knows, we might end up adding one more depending on what happens. But we wanted to look at different issues, and so I started thinking about what the most common issues that come up with a broken hip are. So, for example, one of the chapters is about caregiving from another state. So we looked at a daughter and a father who, the daughter lives in North Carolina and the father lives here in Dallas. And so I looked into the issue of how do you caregive for a person who you don't always see and live with. So that was one chapter. We focused in a different one about, you know, making your home fall-proof. So for that one, I found my story by actually talking with someone who does aging-in-place design and asking him about clients. So that helped me hear about someone who'd had some work done on their house and then getting in on the story that way. And another example of finding a story was through nursing homes and through places where people had wound up after a hip fracture, which is a common thing because most people don't return home or live independently after a fall.
Okay, so let's start with some of the basics then. Like, what did you learn in terms of the morbidity and mortality, to use medical terms, of hip fracture? This is a huge problem, right?
Yeah, it's huge, and that's what I couldn't really believe. The statistic that we cite is one of every 5 people who breaks a hip after the age of 50 dies within a year. And we wanted to look at that because it's a scary statistic, and it makes you think, well, how do you die from a fall? It doesn't, you know, you don't hit your head. What's going on there? And really what ends up happening, and as I'm sure you know it as a doctor, it's really from the complications that arise after the fall. These are people who are older and oftentimes have other illnesses that really get worse rapidly after a fall, after being bedridden, after not being able to move around and recover. And so that's what we really wanted to reveal, is why that statistic is so shocking.
And you reported, I think, something like 260,000 hip fractures every year, people 65 and older?
I don't have that number in front of me, actually, but it's I mean, it's a huge number, and the number, the rate is actually going down of hip fractures. That's the good news. The thing is, the number is going up because of this baby boom population that is reaching that age. So even though the rate isn't growing, we're seeing more and more and more hip fractures, and there's something like 1.5 million people living currently with hip replacements right now.
Wow. And so I was looking, you know, pulling facts out of the stories, but you said, reported a third, one out of every three adults 65 and older fall each year. So the burden of this illness is huge when you think that if one out of every three older adults falls, you know, many, many of those are going to sustain a hip fracture. And then when you think of, when you total up those couple hundred thousand hip fractures every year, one in five of those will die within a year. I mean, just shocking. And so I've seen, you know, I see hip fractures in patients that I care for in the hospital. And of course, usually I would say that the older the patients are, typically the worse they do. But what made this story so spectacular, in addition to the multimedia presentation of it, was the fact that you did focus on so many of these different aspects, including one chapter. And let me point out, these are pretty brief chapters. I mean, these can be read fairly quickly, and they pull you right in with the stories and then kind of give you the information. So I just think of them as really a great teaching tool for, you know, listeners, viewers, patients themselves, and then their caregivers. So the story that you brought up in what you called Chapter 2 was about caregiving from afar, and you focused on a person named Barb Smelzer, who's a daughter, and her father, Earl Schmalz, was 92 years old, a World War II veteran, and he lives in Dallas, but he fell and broke his hip. And so tell us what happened to him.
Yeah, that story was really touching, and what a character. Earl Schmalz, he is a World War II veteran, feisty guy up until the time he broke his hip. He was getting around using a walker, pretty active, and lived on his own in his house. And after he fell, he ended up in a wheelchair. You know, I think he had his hip pinned, and he's okay, but he can't return home because he doesn't want to return home and hire full-time help. He just says he wouldn't feel comfortable with that. So his daughter, meanwhile, lives in North Carolina, and her husband has a job there, and she has kids that are grown, and she can't move back to Dallas. So she spends a good chunk of time every year, every few months, she comes to Dallas and stays here with her dad. She's a full-time caregiver. But even with that, what I learned is that many people, many children who have aging parents are hiring people to help them focus on that care for their parents and organize it. They're called geriatric care managers. So she hired a woman who is a registered nurse and a certified geriatric care manager to sort of oversee the doctors and the health of her father while she can't be there. It serves sort of as her eyes and ears on the ground in Dallas.
Yeah, and we actually did a show a month or so ago on that very topic, and interviewed a local former nurse who's now a caregiver. And so I can see how, with the aging of the population, that's definitely going to be a growth industry. But I was struck, too, how well-researched your journalism was here, because at the end of that chapter, you had several resources, other web links on fall prevention and help for caregivers from resources as varied as Texas Assisted Living Association or the National Alliance for Caregiving. So this was really well-researched.
Yeah, well, you know, the fun part that I did in that story, and like you mentioned, with each story, I tried to work with the other people in the newsroom to either add a video component, a graphic, an infographic component, photos, some other piece that would give it more dimension and more depth and more possibilities for education. So for that story, the caregiving from afar, I actually asked Barb, the daughter, to tell me some of her tips for being a caregiver, for being a daughter living out of state. What were some pieces of advice, you know, that she had? And she wrote up a nice list of 10 or so things, and I edited them down, and that's on the website as well.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa on Health. I'm John Schumann sitting in today for Rich Fisher. My guest is Lauren Silverman, who's a reporter at KERA, our sister public radio station in Dallas, who's done a really magnificent multimedia reporting job on hip fractures in the United States, the epidemiology of it combined with the science and the several intimate stories of families and patients. Lauren, I was really struck by, I think it was chapter 5, there was a story titled Slipping Through the Healthcare Cracks. And what made this story so poignant is that one of the the gentleman who had the hip fracture was the father of a guy named Dan McCoy. Dan is a doctor, a medical doctor, who is the medical director of Blue Cross Blue Shield in Texas. And what did Dr. McCoy find when his father fractured his hip?
This story really was fascinating because when I found out that the head of Blue Cross Blue Shield in Texas, which is the biggest insurer here, millions of people, his father broke his hip and died just days later, I knew I had to talk to him. So I reached out, and it turned out that Dan McCoy, who runs the Texas Blue Cross Blue Shield, was really moved by the experience and actually learned a lot himself, even though he's a health insider and a doctor, from watching what happened to his father. So his father, Bill McCoy, grew up in a part of Texas, a rural part of Texas, on a ranch. And he was a very, as he describes him, a rustic individual, worked hard, ran the ranch up until the time he, very recently actually. And after he fell and broke his hip, Dan McCoy thought that it would be easy to get fixed, or at least easy enough to get him treated and try and move on. Maybe he wouldn't be able to live at home, but at least that he'd be okay. And what turned out happening is that it was July 4th when he picked up his dad, and just as any other system, the healthcare system, works, people were on vacation, surgeons weren't around, the team wasn't there, things got delayed. And what happens with hip fractures and breaks that are serious like that is that the longer you delay surgery for certain patients, it can really drastically reduce their chances of surviving. And his dad got surgery, but it wasn't until at least a day and a half after he entered the hospital. At this point, he hadn't eaten, he hadn't drank in hours and hours and hours. He was a little bit delirious from medication, and he was really in a bad place. And so the surgery, although it went well and there was plenty of, you know, high-tech medical procedures, he developed heart arrhythmia and passed away not long after.
Right, after the surgery is when he developed the heart arrhythmia.
Yes.
And there's a very moving scene that you relay about Dr. Dan McCoy, the son, talking to his mom about what, essentially making a decision about what his father would have wanted, given that he was now in a critical condition.
Yes, and I think that's something that has gotten more attention recently, which is good, is this end-of-life decision and that conversation that many people don't have because it's not a comfortable conversation to have. I don't think anyone likes to talk about death. It's our culture. But, he went down to the cafeteria in the hospital with his mom, and they had to decide whether or not they wanted to, you know, have him on life support or not. And none of the doctors talked to Dan McCoy's mom, he said, about this decision that she'd have to make. And what Dan McCoy really realized throughout this process was the lack of coordination in the healthcare system, the focus on checking boxes and doing things by procedure rather than really thinking in a more holistic sense about patients and their outcomes. And it has inspired him to, as you know, the head of one of these big insurance companies, try and focus on ways to incentivize doctors to work in teams and to work with patients in closer relationships for longer periods of time.
And as Dan McCoy noted in the story, that his father was 93, and so in some ways the healthcare system's epitaph here is, oh, this was a 93-year-old guy. He'd lived a good full life. It was his time to go. And he has this sort of haunting quote that says, I know from being an observer, in that system we could have done better. And, you know, he expresses his sheer frustration with a healthcare system where there was really nobody in charge. I mean, it was just piecemeal care kind of at its worst without teams communicating back and forth, and how his mother felt like there was really kind of no one to turn to.
Yeah, and you know what's interesting is I think that we're moving, and this was his perspective for sure, we've moved to the system where we have experts in so many different fields. We have cardiologists, physical therapists, other specialists, orthopedic surgeons, emergency room doctors. And it seems great to have so many specialists, but like you said, when there's a lack of coordination and no one leading that team, it all falls apart very fast. And I think that we might be seeing a somewhat of a move, or at least a desire for more, you know, overall well-being approach, and not just having a ton of experts and assuming that that's going to solve the problem.
Now, you also have a chapter in here, or a information card really attached to the story, about how to fall-proof one's home. What are some of the takeaways that you remember in terms of fall-proofing, you know, a home?
Yeah, well, this one was fun to do because we got to see some of how people's houses were fixed up so that they had less fall risk, and ways to do it cheaply, not necessarily buying fancy elevators or things like that. There's a lot of small things you can do that make a really big difference. And someone told me also, you know, the only thing that a throw rug is good for is to be thrown out. And I think that that's an obvious message to take away. Throw rugs are bad for falls.
People are slipping on these or tripping on them.
They are tripping on them, getting shoes caught on them. There's a lot of things that you might not think about that can be done to a house to make it more fall-proof, at least. For example, putting in grab bars in bathrooms. That's a top priority because most falls do take place in slippery places like a bathroom, bathtub, and, you know, falling on, usually it's not rug, in a carpet in a bathroom. That can be really, really dangerous. So looking for trip hazards is something that's important. Also, though, widening doorways is really key. And that's not something that initially seems like that big of a deal, but what often ends up happening is people have walkers or even a wheelchair, and they don't use their assisted devices because they can't fit them through doors. And it's sort of an excuse to not use your walker when maybe you should be using your walker. So one thing that's key is making sure you can maneuver safely in your house with your assisted device, and not pushing it aside because it doesn't fit.
One of the other tips that I thought was perhaps maybe the least expensive input was lighting. So bedroom lighting and hallway lighting, and what can you do for that?
Yes, being able to see is really, really important. And being able to turn off and on a light, you know, without having to be in the dark for a few seconds is also helpful. You want to make sure everything is well lit, so that if for some reason there is a trip hazard, at least there's a potential for you to see it. So, that lighting is important. And the one thing, though, that gets overlooked, I think, in making a home fall-proof is there's this other component to preventing falls, which I didn't expect to learn about, and that's actually exercising. The biggest concern for older people who've fallen is that they're going to fall again, and part of that has to do with the fact that they stop getting up, moving around, and exercising. So really keeping that up, as well as making your home fall-proof, is something that's important to preventing fractures and broken bones.
And that's, you know, that's a truism in medicine. That is that people who, you stated it here, people who fall once are more likely to fall again, just like, say, someone who gets pneumonia is more likely to get pneumonia than someone who never has before.
Yes.
And, you know, in that, I want to address that because it turns out, as you, I think, alluded to earlier, it's not really the hip fractures themselves that cause people to die, although, you know, that certainly is a possibility if they don't get medical attention, because if they're lying on the ground and can't move, and in one of your stories, you talk about how an elderly person fell and didn't want to push her call alert button because she didn't really want to inconvenience anybody.
Yeah. And that's common. I mean, you can do everything right for your loved one to try and make sure their home is fall-proof, to provide the resources they need to get help. But sometimes, you know, pride gets in the way, and maybe not even pride, but just not wanting to bother other people. And that's what happened in the story that you're referring to. The woman's name was Jeanette Mariani, and her daughter even works in a nursing home. Her daughter knows what can happen after a broken hip. She got her mom an emergency alert system. She had a fall-proof home, but Jeanette was returning from the bathroom and tripped on a chair, just getting into bed, and she laid on the floor for the entire night until the morning to call for help because she didn't want to bother her family. And like I said, delaying getting care, delaying getting fluids, delaying all of that can reduce your chances for recovery. So it's also important, I think, to talk to your loved ones, your parents, whoever they may be, about what to do if there's a fall, and actually address that beforehand and say, really, you've got to call me, and this is why.
Right, to have that, plan in place, obviously, or to at least have prepared and thought about it somewhat ahead of time.
Yeah, and talking about all of those things can be hard, but I think it's a worthwhile discussion. It really only takes 10-15 minutes to talk about what your plan might be. Another interesting facet of that is this woman, Jeanette Mariani, she had, I think there was at least 5 or 6 children in the family, and Janet is one of her daughters who ended up really taking the lead in caregiving. They had a discussion, the children, about who would be the primary caregiver in a situation like this. And that discussion is important also if you have multiple siblings or multiple people who might have that caregiving role, to talk about who's going to take the lead, just like in a team of doctors, who's going to take that lead. It's important to know who's making decisions and respect those decisions and support them.
Yes, that is very true, and I can tell you that the state laws vary as to who would be what's called a surrogate decision maker in those situations, but in most states, surrogate laws or the lack of a surrogate law would suggest that all adult children are, equally involved in the decision-making, but just like a democracy can be somewhat unruly, it's the medical teams really want one of the children, or if there's a spouse, to be sort of the spokesperson and the decision maker. Not that it invalidates anyone else's input, but to have sort of one person to really do the communicating piece, because otherwise messages get lost or mistranslated.
So exactly. That's
a really good point. You're listening to Studio Tulsa on Health. I'm John Schumann, sitting in for Rich Fisher. My guest today is Lauren Silverman. She is a health reporter at KERA Public Radio in Dallas, and she has led a wonderful multimedia project on hip fractures in the United States. And you can find it online at projects.kera.org/thebrokenhip. And it's multimedia. It has text. It has graphics. As Lauren, you pointed out, it has an infographics. There's some video. There's some audio. It's really just a fabulous tool. And I would say I'm sharing this with patients of mine, because whether they're elderly patients themselves who are willing to click on a computer, or they're caregiving children, because it's absolutely a fabulous resource. And like any well-researched information source, it has other links and other validated medical information that people can use. I wanted to turn the page here and ask about the technology of hip repair, because you did a chapter on that as well. Tell us what your takeaways were from how the science of orthopedic hip repair has changed over the recent decades.
Well, I learned something that really stuck with me, which is that some of the earliest hip repairs were actually done using different substances, everything from ivory to glass. And now, we mostly use metal-based, both metal and ceramic, for repair of hip fractures, and that's what has seemed to work the best. So there's been obvious advances in the technology and the substances that we use and the substances we don't use. Orthopedic surgeons used to rely much more heavily on something called bone cement to keep the artificial hip in place. And now they're doing something pretty cool, which is trying to get the bone to naturally grow onto the replacement without using bone cement. So there's different advances that were exciting to hear about in terms of technology, but really I think that there's more to do. Anyone who's watched the news in the past few years has heard problems about hip replacements and their durability, which isn't as big of a deal for people who are in their 80s or 90s getting a hip replacement. But if you're younger and you're getting a hip replacement, you really want that to last. And we're still not at the point where you can rely on that for decades. It's something that right now is pretty good, if you're already older.
Yeah, and I think that's a really important distinction, because when younger folks are getting hip replacements, that's usually due to arthritis, like worn-out hips,
yes.
Not from hip fractures. That we're really focusing here on hip fractures in the elderly, so that's a good point.
Yeah, but I was also surprised, though, about the number of ways you can treat a hip fracture, and even what we refer to as a hip fracture, which sometimes isn't even what most people consider the hip. I thought a hip fracture really meant the hip. Sometimes it means the top of the femur. Sometimes it's what we actually would consider a pelvic fracture. So there's lots of different ways you can get a hairline, a small fracture in those bones that are around the hip area, and we generally refer to them from what I learned as hip fractures, but they all have very different treatments depending on what type of break it is, how serious, whether it can be repaired with pins, or whether it needs a full-on replacement, and that just really depends, I think, on the individual's situation and what type of fall and how healthy they are.
I can also tell you, if you look at the research on this in terms of the utilization just across Medicare, depending on what region of the country you're in, local practice variation, it depends a lot on basically, which institution and which doctor you go to. There's a lot of research on that, and it's actually quite interesting. But a lot of it has to do with who the surgeon's mentor was and what the surgeon
is. Their preference.
Exactly. Okay, last gear shift here. And again, I think this is a spectacular resource that you've put together. And this multimedia journalism, I wanted to ask, you told me offline that this was really the first time you'd done this at KERA. Where did you adopt the style of this reporting piece from?
It was a bit of a hodgepodge from a couple of things that really inspired us. And one was the New York Times. They have something called the Snowfall Project, which is interactive in this same way and just a beautiful presentation. Another example was from WBUR, a local NPR station in Boston. They had a series for the Whitey Bulger case that they did in a somewhat similar style. So we really looked around to see what we liked and then used something called the Creativist app to tell the story in the format that you see online. And I, luckily, had two other people really working on the online part with me, so I could focus most of my time on just reporting and getting audio and photos for what we put online. So it was a team approach where I would do the reporting, I would get the story, I would help write some web text, but then really hand it off to my partners, Ryan Tainter and Eric Austin, who would work on the presentation for the digital side. And then we also had someone who works in the station on video who would sometimes come out with me if I thought there was a good video opportunity. But yeah, the presentation was really pulled from different sources that we were inspired by, and it's not perfect by any means. There are things that we are learning from and that we're going to change if we decide to, when we decide to dive into another project, multimedia.
Lauren Silverman is a health reporter at KERA in Dallas, and the name of the project is The Broken Hip, and you can find it online. We'll, of course, link to it on our website. Lauren Silverman, thank you so much for being on Studio Tulsa on Health.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Well, that's our show for today. Studio Tulsa on Health is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views expressed by our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of the University of Tulsa. I'm John Schumann, sitting in for Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.